Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Welcome. This session, so you know you're in the right place, is Civil Rights Icons and Unsung Heroes. So let me quickly introduce our distinguished panelists. Brilliant introductions. I had of them at my house on the kitchen table, so here we go. Just so that you can really fully appreciate them, I'll be reading from this book. Kenneth Mack, who is closest to me, is an author, historian, and professor of law at Harvard University. His 2012 book, Representing the Race, was selected as one of the 50 best nonfiction books of the year by the Washington Post. Civil Rights Icons and Unsung Heroes is where he is today. And a fun fact about Ken, he's a member of a certain historian book club that is pulled together by the President of the United States. There you go. That'd be one Barack Obama. All right, moving on. Jean Theo Harris is the author of The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. The New York Times calls this comprehensive biography of Rosa Parks richly informative, calmly passionate, and much needed. Jean Theo Harris. And then, last but not least, my buddy on the air, as soon as I find his thing, right here coming up, is Peniel Joseph, who's right, this guy got Peniel, you found your own thing and then I lost it. Wait a minute, I got it in here. Here we go. Peniel Joseph is a leading scholar on African American history, a professor at Tufts University, and a national commentator on race, democracy, and civil rights. His latest book, Stokely: A Life, is the first major biography of the civil rights leader who coined the term Black Power. Fun fact about Peniel, he has a center at Tufts that he organized himself to deal with issues of, in the contemporary times, really, of race and history. So there are often events there, and you should check that out if you want to follow up with what things he's doing. So you've heard the title, and on the face, I think that it may seem that, of course, they're all connected because they're writing about civil rights figures, civil rights lawyers, civil rights mother of the civil rights movement, Rosa Parks, someone folks know by two words, Stokely Carmichael. And yes, that is a connection. But as I read all of these books and I thought about it, there's a commonality of two themes. And I think it's assumption and expectation. Assumption and expectation. So we're going to get them to talk about, as they wrote about these folks, in ways that you've not heard. That's the refreshing part of the discussion. Why assumption and expectation runs through and connects all three of these books. So I say that because they are telling you the real story of the characters, not what you believe the story is of these characters. Ken Mack has something that he says that I'm paraphrasing here. These are stories we think we know, but we do not. So I'm going to start with Ken. And Ken, I want to ask you if you would describe who your civil rights lawyers are that you profile in your book, who they are assumed to be, and who they are.
Okay. So my book's called Representing the Race, the Creation of a Civil Rights Lawyer, and it's a collective biography of about six civil rights lawyers, ranging from people who are were quite famous, like Thurgood Marshall, to people who were well-known in their own time but have sort of become obscure, like Los Angeles lawyer Lauren Miller, who argued one of the racially restrictive covenant cases in the Supreme Court, to people who are somewhat obscure or just being rediscovered, like the feminist activist and icon Pauli Murray. And what I was working against is a set of assumptions about these lawyers, is that the only thing to tell about their story is the story of protest. The only thing that to tell about their story is that they are representatives of a minority group in a world that wants to deny that group basic fundamental rights. Now, they were representatives of a minority group. They were brave figures. They were admirable figures. But what I try to do in the book is really make the question representation into a question. It's not a statement about what they do. It's a question I ask about what they do. What does it mean to represent a minority group in the world of Jim Crow when you're a lawyer? And the book is all about how these lawyers are—they're a little bit on both sides of the color line. They're the black people who can speak to white communities, to white jurors, to white judges, to white lawyers. That's part of their power, and then they claim to represent the interests of black communities. And the book is all about how they struggle with that. The book is about how this familiar story that we think of we know about these kinds of lawyers, that they were representatives of a disempowered group, is really a question. What does it mean to represent a minority group? It means to be a little bit like the majority. And that's not necessarily a good or a bad thing. It's just a deeply conflicted identity that I wrote my book to try to expose to the larger public.
As I read your book, Ken, I was struck by hearing words of W.E.B. Du Bois about double consciousness and about how black folks in general have to walk in both sides of the aisle. Now, can you take W.B. Du Bois's words and concept and, you know, sort of explain that in the framework of what you've talked about in the stories of these men and women?
Yeah, I think that many, many people who write about race in America, particularly with African Americans, are deeply influenced by Du Bois's idea of double consciousness, which, you know, I obviously was as well. I mean, it's a complicated idea if you read The Souls of Black Folk. He sort of talks about sort of looking through yourself through the eyes of another, that whites are always your subject to what we academics call the white gaze. You know, you're always subject to public scrutiny. But what I really want to talk about is, you know, what does it really mean to be a lawyer? And how is that really different? And not just sort of generic Du Boisian double consciousness. But to be a lawyer was, you were the person in the world of Jim Crow who made your living, made your bread and butter by convincing white people that you were right. Right? So to be a black lawyer in this time, in this period, to be a Thurgood Marshall, to be a successful Thurgood Marshall, you had to be the person to go into court and convince a group of white jurors and white judges that you were right. To make a living at the practice of law, which is what most of these folks had to do, you had to be the person who convinced white people that you were right. And it's a unique role in the world of Jim Crow. It's not just Du Boisian double consciousness. It's something unique in the world of racial politics about being a black lawyer in this place and time. And I sort of talk about how all these lawyers kind of really struggle with this idea from men to women. And one of the lawyers we talk about in the book is Pauli Murray, who's one of the people who really invented sex discrimination, very influential on people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Eleanor Roosevelt, and how Pauli Murray's sort of closeted and complicated sexual identity played out in her struggle with what did it mean to be a black lawyer in a courtroom, and how that struggle caused her to invent, really, I mean, invent, and I don't say this as an exaggeration, invent sex discrimination as a category of law, this idea that affects people all over the world.
So that's representing the race, a little taste of it. We'll be back to that in just a second, Ken Mack. And now moving on to Jean Theor Harris. I bet you everybody in this room says, well, we know Rosa Parks. We know all about Rosa Parks. In fact, there was a study done not long ago, and the result was that if you stopped any school kids or the average, you know, informed persons, that they knew two names from the civil rights movement. One was Rosa Parks. The other was Martin Luther King Jr. And, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. has a holiday to help you remember. So it's pretty impressive that those are the two names. But again, back to our theme of assumption and expectation, we find in Jean Theor Harris's book, The Rebellious Life of Rosa Parks, that who she was assumed to be is not who she was. Please tell us who she was assumed to be and who she was, Rosa Parks.
Right. Well, probably all of us, most of us in this room, right, learned about Rosa Parks well before college, right? You learn about her now, elementary school, middle school. She's one of the first people we learn about. And that tends to be the version of Rosa Parks that's, as my students like to call her, the bus lady, right? She's the bus lady. And we saw a kind of replay of this. I don't know if people remember. About a year and a half ago, the statue of Rosa Parks was put in the Capitol. It's the first statue of a black person in the Capitol. And we had this like bipartisan extravaganza. But even there, Nancy Pelosi gets up and says, Rosa Parks, she did what was natural. She was tired, so she sat down, right? Nancy Pelosi in the Capitol 2013. Barack Obama talks about Rosa Parks' singular act of courage. So I wrote my book in many ways to get us past that version and to really think about Rosa Parks, not about that one day on the bus, but about really almost a 70-year span of political activity. And that even those of us who knew she wasn't just a tired seamstress, I think had no idea, and this I very much speak for myself, how formidable, how long, how wide her political work was. That really begins with the Scottsboro case. She meets her husband. Her husband's working on the Scottsboro case. He's the first real activist she ever met. And they get married, and that's where she begins, with Scottsboro. She spends the 40s and 50s doing all this criminal justice work and voter registration work. She and Edie Nixon transform Montgomery's NAACP into an activist chapter above the objections of many of the middle-class members, right? So even those of us who knew that she was in the NAACP, I think what it means to do the work that Rosa Parks, Edie Nixon, and a small group of activists in Alabama were doing was very much risking their lives in the 1940s, was very much being rebellious. Obviously, then there's 1955, her bus stand. In many ways, I think, again, every elementary school learns that Rosa Parks is courageous, but what actually makes that stand courageous, I argue in the book, is she's done stuff like this before. Other people she knows have done stuff like this before, right? Over and over and over, they've tried to challenge things. Over and over and over, it has not worked. She has this quote, kind of in the 1950s, like, it was difficult to keep going when all our efforts seemed in vain. So in some sense, part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to reframe that courage to be the courage of perseverance, the courage of doing it again and again and again. And obviously in 1955, people are at a different point. People are at a breaking point. So that act in 1955 will catapult her sort of into history in a different way. But it is part of a much longer thing. And then the second half of my book is about Rosa Parks' life in Detroit, because Rosa Parks is forced to leave Montgomery 8 months after the Montgomery bus boycott ends. She can't find work. They're still getting death threats. And she will spend more than half of her political life fighting the racism of the North, fighting against the war in Vietnam, fighting for Black history in the curriculum, fighting for criminal justice against the death penalty. So the second half of the book really takes us out of Montgomery. Again, when people talk about Rosa Parks, there's usually the last sentence, then she goes to Detroit. It's like it's the happy ending. It's the vacation home, right? Rosa Parks describes Detroit as the promised land that wasn't. And so to see Rosa Parks, she's living in what she describes as a ghetto. It's about a mile from where the Detroit riot will break out in 1967. So I think it forces us both to see the national character of the Black freedom struggle, to see how long. So she keeps going in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, really till the end of her life, insistent that the movement isn't over. So again, I think the last thing about her that is not the assumption is, I think Rosa Parks is often used as kind of, hey, look, we've arrived. It's the happy ending. When the actual Rosa Parks was saying, we have much work to go. And so I think it's returning that Rosa Parks to our
And reading your fabulous book, which, you know, I read like this, what? Really? What? I'm telling you, you just can't even get your mind around it. Here's a quote that I pulled out because I think it's a way for you to help people understand why this is called The Rebellious Life of Rosa Parks. According to Septima Clark, this is a quote from her, Rosa Parks was afraid for white people to know how radical she was. That's an incredible statement about all of our image, or many people's image of who she was, even those of us who knew she was not a tired seamstress and who knew about her NAACP work. Right. And so that, to me, was an amazing statement to be made by someone who knew her very well, and then, of course, the Detroit part of it added to it. In your writing of this, were you having the same response? You knew she wasn't a tired seamstress, but did you know it was this intense?
No. So... partly I decided to write the book after I got interested in thinking about her funeral. People may remember Rosa Parks dies in October 2005. She's the first woman, first civilian ever to lie in honor in the Capitol, right? It's just an extraordinary spectacle. And so I get interested in the story partly to think about kind of the memory, historical memory in the civil rights movement. And so the first piece I do is sort of thinking about how we can't separate why we have a national funeral for Rosa Parks from 2 months earlier we had Hurricane Katrina, and thinking about the uses of civil rights history in the present. A friend says, will you turn that into an article for my book? And so then I have to flesh it out. I have to sort of give some meat to it. And I had come to this project as an historian of the movement in the North. And then here I start to do work on Rosa Parks, and I realize how much there was that we hadn't seen, how much there was that we'd kind of taken for granted that we knew her, particularly, again, this second half of the story that just gets eclipsed in this one or two sentences, and then she goes to Detroit. And so for me, just seeing how many places she's at, how many people remember that goofy movie Forrest Gump? Literally doing the research for this book was like being with a real Forrest Gump, because I would look and it's like, oh, there she is at the Winter Soldier hearings. Oh, there she is at, there she is at the Million Man March. There she is in the late 40s, you know, driving around Alabama taking testimony for all of these rape cases. There she is, you know, at the signing of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 with Lyndon Johnson. There she is, you know, 6 months earlier with Malcolm X, right? The last message that Malcolm X gives is in Detroit. Rosa Parks is there with him. She meets Malcolm X three times. I mean, she's everywhere. And I think writing this book, that feeling of just astonishment. And I think a lot of times when you do a revisionist book or you sort of deconstruct someone, they get less interesting, they get less formidable and amazing. And I think one of the things that was so incredible about writing a book about Rosa Parks is how much more formidable she got the more you looked. Mm-hmm. How much wider, how much deeper, how much more courageous. Right? I think, again, I said this before, but I think there's a cliche that she was courageous, but I mean, to think about, so that she keeps going in 1970 and 1980, and that nobody would have faulted her if she said, you know, I've been doing this for 30, 40 years. I'm ready to sit down and, like, let...
For real.
For real.
Yeah.
Right? No. For real, sit down, right? And that she doesn't, and that she just... She goes and she goes and she goes. So one of the last things I discover is she joins Harry Belafonte and Danny Glover 8 days after 9/11 in a public statement basically saying, no war, we have to work with the international community, no retaliation... This is 2001, right? That she's still seeing kind of justice in a global sense. And so there was just something kind of awesome about getting to do this and continuing to get to do this.
Well, you're revisioning an icon, and that's pretty powerful. Now, speaking of someone that folks think they know in one moment and in two words, that would be Stokely Carmichael, Peniel Joseph. He's frozen in time. With black power, that's it. That's what folks know. And the assumption about him is one thing, but as you have found, it's something different when you look at him more closely. So who was he assumed to be, and who was he?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in terms of my research on Stokely, it goes back to growing up in New York City. Both of my parents, Haitian immigrants, came to the United States in 1964, and I found out about Haitian history, about African-American history, Caribbean history through my mother. And I first encountered Stokely Carmichael in junior high school through Eyes on the Prize, something that Callie, a monumental watershed, very important series, PBS series that Callie Crossley was one of the
film
producers.
Series, always touted as one of the best, but continue.
And I can vouch for that. And Stokely is right there, full of life. He's 24 years old, and he's screaming black power. And that really got me. Stokely, more than Malcolm X, was my tipping point into diving into black radicalism and finding out about what Cedric Robinson calls the black radical tradition, the work of Du Bois, the work of Lorraine Hansberry, Ida B. Wells, Ella Baker. And I think Stokely is assumed to be an angry young man who was a bright, streaking comet who sort of fades after the Black Power call. And the research I did, I spent 10 years working on this book, really showed me what a complicated figure he was, but also what a revolutionary figure he was. One of the things I argue in terms of Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture is that along with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., he's one of these three, this triumvirate that globally transforms how we think about race and class and revolution in a fundamental way.
And don't you say he's a bridge? You see him as a bridge.
Absolutely.
Between
those two. He's a bridge figure between Malcolm and Martin, between civil rights and black power. And the interesting thing for me was finding out how deep his activist roots were. The fact that, you know, he's coming from the Caribbean, Port of Spain, Trinidad. He learns to sort of have an appreciation for the underdog in a house full of women in Port of Spain, Trinidad, who are raising him before he comes to the United States. He comes to the Bronx 2 weeks before his 11th birthday. And in New York City, he becomes an activist as a teenager. And he imbibes so many different traditions. So he goes to Bronx Science High School, which is one of the best public schools in the country at the time. It's a predominantly white, predominantly Jewish school. He's one of eight black kids, I should say, just black, out of over 300, class of 1960. And he goes to school with all these different luminaries in terms of Jeff Greenfield, Todd Gitlin, all these different activists who are at Bronx Science. But at Bronx Science, he's actually organizing with Bayard Rustin, the great black social democratic organizers, openly gay. But he's also organizing with the sons and daughters of what we might call the white left, right? People who are, Stokely's organizing in pro-Israel marches in the 1950s, which is very interesting because by 67, he's going full on out for Palestinian liberation. So he's filled with all these different juxtapositions. And the interesting thing for me about Stokely was that even before the sit-in movement and before he joins the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, in 1960, he's a door-to-door activist. He's an organizer. He's in study groups. He's reading about revolution and political activism. So part of the tradition that he imbibes, too, is a revolutionary Pan-African tradition. He's listening to music by Miriam Makeba. He's finding out about Kwame Nkrumah, who's really the father of post-war Pan-Africanism. He's finding out about Sékou Touré in Guinea. So he comes to Howard University 18, 19 years old as an activist. He participates in sit-in movements. And the surprising thing for me doing the research was how much of a participant he was, a key participant, during the second half of the heroic period of the civil rights movement from 60 to 65. So he's arrested for the first time in Mississippi in 1961. And when we talk about the way history is rewritten, people don't think of him as somebody who was a Southern civil rights activist, who was one of the main participants in that movement, who everybody knew, who was sleeping on the floors of shotgun shacks in Mississippi and Alabama, who was at Howard University, who was working with Gloria Richardson in Cambridge, Maryland. So I think the surprising thing as I was doing the research, and I echo what Gene was saying in terms of Forrest Gump and feeling that this person is everywhere, was just how much more of a nuanced thinking intellectual figure he was from what I had seen, the clips that I had seen. You know, he's so angry. And when you're a kid, you're like, all right, right on. I'm angry too. But as you're delving deeper into this, his complexity was really awesome.
Could you speak a little bit about his being rising from a community of people that were feeling a certain way and thinking a certain way about making change? Because so often he's portrayed, again, assumptions, some singular guy. He sort of came to it in his room by himself, and then he just, you know, went on and made himself the guy with the raised fist. But he came from really an earth of community folks.
Yeah, no, he's coming out of a black radical tradition, and he's being mentored by people like Ella Baker, the great organizer of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, but who was a labor organizer, part of the NAACP, who was part of SCLC, who mentored Martin Luther King Jr., even at times when he didn't realize he was being mentored. He's mentored by Fannie Lou Hamer. He's mentored by this great community of black women and men who are at times intellectuals, at times sharecroppers. I mean, he says in his posthumously published autobiography, Ready for Revolution, that when he first sees the Mississippi Delta in 1961, he falls in love with the Delta, and he falls in love with the black people in the Delta. And so he's saying that. He's saying that these are the folks who taught him what activism, what humanity, what citizenship, what democracy really meant. So Stokely, you're exactly right. He's not this singular figure. He's being brought up from, really, he talks about falling in love with black people, and the reason he loves Martin Luther King Jr. is because Martin Luther King loved poor black people. So they converge, mm-hmm. even though they're both these, you know, Stokely's anti-war activism is going to help inspire King. Stokely's activism helps inspire the Black Panthers. He says he loves black people, especially poor black people. And one anecdote I'll leave us with is that he has an interview in 1965 with Studs Terkel in Chicago. And he's telling Studs Terkel that Fannie Lou Hamer, the sharecropper from Ruleville, Mississippi, is more important than Martin Luther King Jr. And Studs Terkel says, you know, what do you mean that she, you know, I know Fannie Lou Hamer is important, but Dr. King, you know, he just got the Nobel Prize. How could he be more important? And Stokely says that Fannie Lou Hamer is more important because there's more Fannie Lou Hamers in the United States of America than Martin Luther King Jr.'s.
Okay. Yeah. And so that leads me to the storytelling part, because I would like each of you to tell a story. I'm going to start with you, Ken, that really illustrates, you know, the essence of what you were trying to do. I have a favorite, you know, in your book, and you can ignore me and go and do what you want to do. But I like the one about John Mercer Langston and how he got admitted to the bar, because it speaks to the essence of this struggle that your group of lawyers were going through in trying to represent, the community folk and the larger community.
Well, yeah, let me talk just a little bit about John Mercer Langston. I mean, today most people don't know who John Mercer Langston was. He lived in the 19th century. He was born in the 1830s. He winds up dying in the 1890s. He was the second most famous black person in the 19th century. Well, actually, no, there's three people who are kind of competing with each other sort of after the Civil War. It's Frederick Douglass, mm-hmm. Booker T. Washington, and John Mercer Langston. Mm-hmm. These are the three people who think that they're the most prominent Negro in America. Now, we haven't heard much about John Mercer Langston today, and there's a reason for that. John Mercer Langston was a lawyer. He was a lawyer in... He is, like many of the people in my book, he's biracial. He's actually the son of a white slave owner in Virginia and a woman of African descent. And his father lives openly with his mother and has three sons. And he decides, you know, he's in Virginia, so he decides he wants his sons to be educated. That's not going to happen in Virginia. So he sends them to Ohio, and Langston goes to Oberlin College. So Oberlin College is, of course, one of the first, is the first college in the country to admit African Americans and women. And he gets a degree from Oberlin College, thinks he's going to be a preacher, studies theology, and he winds up being one of the most educated people, black or white, in the country. And then he decides he wants to become a lawyer. Well, you know, he lives in Ohio, and in Ohio, at the time he wants to become a lawyer, black people can sort of vote, at least if they pass for white, because under Ohio law, African Americans can't vote. Lots of things African Americans can't legally do in Ohio. So, you know, he wants to become a lawyer. He gets his abolitionist lawyer to train him, and he goes, and, you know, at that point, you know, you don't take the bar exam. You go before a panel of judges. So, you know, Langston goes before this panel of judges. And Langston is, you know, when my book got reviewed in the Washington Post, they put this photograph of Langston, which is very emblematic of him. You know, he's very proud. He's very proper. He looks like this 19th century guy, you know, dressed in all black. He always looks fierce. You never see a picture of him with, you know, anything other than fierceness on his face. And he really had to be because he had sort of problems like just getting admitted to the bar. Well, they didn't admit black people to the bar in Ohio. Or at least they weren't sure if they could admit a black person to the bar in Ohio, because they never had. There'd never been a black lawyer. Black people don't even have basic rights, so the judges think, you know, can we admit him to the bar? So his sponsor says, you know, you can admit him to the bar because he's white. Of course, he's biracial. Actually, he's the uncle of Langston Hughes. You know, Langston Hughes is named for John Mercer Langston.
The poet.
Yes, the poet. Mm-hmm. So you can admit him because he's white. So, you know, the judge sort of says, stand on up, and Langston stands up, and he's like this proper guy. And he does look kind of weird. You know, in the 19th century, you know, black people are not supposed to look like John Mercer Langston or act like him. And he kind of looks at him and kind of, you know, thinks about it and doesn't say another word and just wears him in. And this is how he becomes a lawyer. He becomes a lawyer by becoming a white lawyer. And actually, this is kind of one of the things I use as a framing device to frame the entire book. He becomes a successful lawyer in Ohio. All of his clients are white. He says black people won't hire him because why would you hire the black lawyer? As a matter of fact, all these black lawyers have the same problem. Thurgood Marshall, Charles Houston, when Thurgood Marshall comes along, the NAACP will not use black lawyers for its civil rights cases because why would you use the black lawyer? You know, you're in a racist world. Of course you'll use the white lawyer, right? So Langston is the first person to sort of present this problem to the public, and he gets white people to hire him. And he becomes, you know, basically this prominent Ohio lawyer, all white clientele, but at the same time, he is the most prominent African-American in Ohio. Actually, one of the most prominent African-Americans in the country. You know, the first national African-American organization is called the National Equal Rights League. It's formed in 1864 in the middle of the Civil War as African-Americans are trying to figure out, you know, what, you know, are we going to be free? What's freedom going to mean? And they elect Langston president of the National Equal Rights League. He's admitted to the bar as a white lawyer. All of his clients are white. White people like him. They sort of think he's sort of one of them. But at the same time, he's the most prominent black person in Ohio and one of the most prominent black people in the country. And this is the thing that he wrestles with his whole life. And actually, it is the reason why there are many, many reasons why we know Frederick Douglass better than we know Langston, because Frederick Douglass had been a slave. There are ways in which, again, Douglass has that booming voice, there are ways in which Douglass always was seen as more authentic than Langston. So these guys are always sort of jockeying back and forth through the rest of the 19th century about, you know, who's the most prominent Negro in America. And I'll give you this one last thing. You know, I went to Frederick Douglass's, the last house he lived in is in Anacostia in southeast Washington, D.C., and they've got sort of his room sort of preserved, and you can see all the things that were in it when, you know, about the time of his death. And one of the things that's in Frederick Douglass's room is a little statue that's on his side table. And the statue is of John Mercer Langston, because he understood that this was both his rival and the person he had the most commonality with in the 19th century. But Langston was a lawyer, and for that reason, it was easier for him to appeal to whites, but he was always struggling with this problem of being inauthentic. So I sort of use this as a kind of framing device that all the lawyers I write about, from Thurgood Marshall to Pauli Murray to Charles Houston to Lauren Miller, they all sort of have to struggle with this as a problem.
Being representative and what it means.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jean Theo Harris. One of my moments really came as I'm reading. So we have the Montgomery bus boycotts kick off. Nobody knows if it's going to work. That first day, it works. People are at the rally. They're so thrilled. They're so excited. And guess who doesn't speak at the rally? I'm appalled to learn that I did not know that.
Right.
And that on many other occasions, would you tell the story, please, of what happened and where Rosa Parks was while everybody was invoking her name to, gin up enthusiasm and support for one of the most famous civil rights boycotts in history?
Well, if we come back a few days. So Rosa Parks makes her bus stand on Thursday night. This is December 1st, Thursday night. She's coming home from work. She waits to get a less crowded bus. It's about 5:30 at night, the bus fills up. One white man standing. Four people are going to have to move for this one person, and she refuses. The bus driver then calls the police. She believes that the police don't want to arrest her, just evict her, but the bus driver insists. She is arrested and taken to jail. bailed out 3 or 4 hours later. And when they realize she's okay, E.D. Nixon, is the who is a longtime friend, is kind of delighted because she's sort of the test case that they want. Meanwhile, so she's Raymond, her husband's not that excited about this. He's worried both that they'll be killed, but also many movements that they had been a part of, people get shaky. And he felt like they weren't going to stick with them. But she decides that night, late that night, that she's willing to go forward with the test case and calls a young black lawyer in town, a brand new lawyer in town by the name of Fred Gray. And very late that night, Fred Gray calls Joanne Robinson, who's the head of the Women's Political Council, which is a middle-class black women's organization that had been very active around the bus. And it's the middle of that night, which is, we're still at Thursday night, that the Women's Political Council decides they're going to call for this one-day boycott on Monday. And Joanne Robinson says that she doesn't think she has to call Rosa Parks. Which I think speaks to kind of class and education divides in the black community. All right, so we get to Friday morning. So
Joanne Robinson, quote in Eyes on the Prize, was, we didn't go to bed that night. We stayed up all night and printed those mimeographs. Continue.
Exactly. So she sneaks in. She's a professor. She sneaks into the college with two students, and a colleague lets her in the mimeograph room. They run off 35,000 copies. They blanket Montgomery with it on Friday morning. Meanwhile, E.D. Nixon starts calling the ministers, calls a young Martin Luther King at 6 a.m. King says, can you call me back? Right? King doesn't know. He's Martin Luther King. In neon, he's a 26-year-old minister. He will obviously step up to become the leader. Rosa Parks doesn't find out about the boycott till lunchtime. She usually takes her lunch with Fred Gray. She goes over to Fred Gray's law office on Friday. That's when she finds out about the boycott. Everyone's nervous that weekend. Will people stay off the bus? She says the most exciting moment of the boycott for her is waking up Monday morning and realizing that people had. She goes to court that morning. And then that night, there's a big mass meeting at Holt Street Baptist Church. It's packed, 5,000 people in the sanctuary. Some people estimate 10,000 people outside. The church turns its amplification like outside so people can hear. So she's on the dais that night. And she gets, from what people describe, as like a minutes-long standing ovation, and people are yelling, speak, 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 and she doesn't speak. And she says in a later interview, she says, well, I asked someone if I should speak, and they said, well, you've said enough already. And Rosa Parks hadn't really said much that weekend. She had purposely kept herself out of the paper, and I think we could think about what she might have said that night, right? I mean, so she's been an activist for 2 decades by that point, right? And so the kind of perspective she would have brought, I mean, just remembering, Fred Gray, her lawyer, 25 years old. Martin Luther King, 26 years old. Most of the people that we associate with the boycott are very young at this point, right? And she would have brought this perspective of, like, being in this. And then the kind of amazing thing of having that morning where history is now moved, right? Of spending so long kind of doing these things where they don't go anywhere, and then getting to be at this moment when it finally does. And so there is something, I think, about imagining what she would have said that day, that night. And, you know, again, fast forward, 1963, the March on Washington. Rosa Parks, again, on the dais at the March on Washington, doesn't get to speak. And one last story, Gloria Richardson, who Neil mentioned, Gloria Richardson was the leader of the Cambridge movement, tells this story. Before the speeches, Lena Horne and Gloria Richardson had been taking Rosa Parks around to all these international journalists that had come to the March on Washington and saying, she's the story. She's who started it, not Martin Luther King. And Gloria Richardson says her and Lena Horne get sent home early from the March on Washington for their own safety. But she says they hear King. They don't actually get to stay for King's speech. They hear it in the taxi cab, and she believes it's because they were kind of saying, you need to be talking to Rosa Parks. She's the story. And as many of you know, no women get to speak at the March on Washington. So it's sort of a continuing issue.
And would you tell the part about her going back to the office and answering the phone?
Oh, yeah. So I forgot to tell that part. Yeah. So she...
It's a big one.
It's a good one. She's her court date is in the morning, and if you look, the cover of my book has her going into court that morning. You can see people are packed, and for somebody like Rosa Parks or Edie Nixon, they'd never, black people stayed away from the courthouse unless you absolutely had to be there. And so it's this amazing thing where people are, you know, just on the move. So it's, you know, it's less than a half hour, her trial, and she decides not to go to work. She works at a segregated downtown department store, which means that black people can shop there, but they can't try on the clothes. And it means for employees that she can't use the employee lunchroom. The elevators are segregated. So she doesn't go to work. And she goes to answer the phones at Fred Gray's office. She would help him a lot of times. And so she's answering the phones. And she's pretending she's not her. So there are people are calling to ask about the boycott, ask about this Parks woman. And she's, you know, telling them things, telling there's going to be this meeting that night at Holt Street. Meanwhile, Fred Gray is at a meeting with Martin Luther King, with Edie Nixon, which will be the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. The organization's called the Montgomery Improvement Association, right? And Rosa Parks gets left behind in Fred Gray's law office to answer the phones, pretending that she's not herself. Because she definitely walks this interesting line between constantly doing things and then also covering up what she's doing. And I think that moment of that she wants to be useful. She also doesn't, like, go home. She could obviously have just gone home and it had been a big day. She doesn't go home. She doesn't go to work. She wants to be useful. But there she is sort of answering phones, not saying it's her, while they create this organization in her name. But, you know, they're very happy to have her as a symbol. But
just don't talk. Okay. So, Peniel, one of the things that when people have an understanding, or they think they have an understanding of who Stokely Carmichael is, he's this sort of fierce, nasty, racist, evil guy. And one of the things that you bring out in the book that's interesting is that he's actually kind of funny. and there's a whole other side to him. And he's struggling around trying to represent a vision, but with some humor. And these were tough times. I wish you'd tell a story that illustrated that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, there's plenty. I mean, Stokely is, in a lot of ways, Malcolm X used humor to deflect what was going on as well, and to tell stories and craft narratives. I mean, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, was really the most popular student at Bronx Science. I mean, if he walked into this room right now, he's enormously charismatic and really would be the most charismatic, funny person, even in a room full of charismatic, funny people, right? You know, men and women are drawn to him, which is sort of rare, right? He's the kind of guy who, a great story is Mississippi Freedom Summer. And he's the second congressional district director during Freedom Summer. And I say that because there's a great documentary out about Freedom Summer, but Stokely's not in it until the final scene. And that final scene by Stanley Nelson, brilliant filmmaker. And Freedom Summer is 1964, where there's over 1,000 volunteers, predominantly white volunteers, that work with an indigenous black movement for voter registration in Mississippi. And Stokely...
And that's the documentary, not that horrific, horrible film by the same name, which is a lie, made by Hollywood.
Mississippi Burning.
Thank you.
Yeah, not Mississippi Burning.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, during Freedom Summer, Stokely is the second congressional district director in Greenwood. So people like Bob Zellner, other people are working under him. And he is getting these packages, these care packages, from an organization of people around the country, both in New York and other places, that are called the Friends and Supporters of Stokely Carmichael. And he calls it FASC, F-A-S-C. And so he in Greenwood, to ease up the tension, and this is the summer of 64, as soon as they arrive, three civil rights workers are killed, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. So it's a very, very tense situation. Five other bodies are found that summer as well. The Civil Rights Act is passed July 2nd, so this is 50 years ago, this past summer. He gives out soap, toothpaste, toothbrush to different people who are in Greenwood, black, white, everybody. And he says that, FASC giveth and FASC taketh away, in the sense that, people who are good are down with him. He's going to give and people aren't. He's not. But he really gives to everyone. He's one. When we look at the memoirs from Freedom Summer, which are really predominantly white memoirs, although there's some, like the African-American lawyer Len Holt, who has a great memoir. Many, many white activists remember Stokely Carmichael as somebody who was enormously funny, somebody who was constantly teasing people as well. And one of the things that Stokely says is that very early on, he learned that he had to control his fear, because one of the amazing scenes in his life is when he's in Mississippi in 1961 as a freedom rider and trying to desegregate. They fly into New Orleans and then take a train from New Orleans to Mississippi. But on the train, there's a mob that's waiting for them at the New Orleans train station. And he's with eight other people, and it's a mixed race group. But the mob is particularly incensed because women are part of it, white women, like Joanne Trumpauer. And one of the scenes he remembers is an elderly white woman shaking a cane at the whole group, right? And he didn't think they'd get out of there alive. And what he says in his memoir is that the way he faced his fear is to think to himself that somebody was going to die, but it wasn't going to be him. It was going to be the guy next to him.
Right? Okay.
And so what's interesting about him, he's got a gallows sense of humor. He's a guy with an enormous charisma, but he's somebody who teases people. He's got great impressions of Martin Luther King Jr., great impressions of so many different movement people, and somebody who was much lighter of a personality at times than his public image.
So let me... Oh, are we here? Okay. I want to really leave a lot... I had asked our wonderful coordinator here to let me know when 30 minutes was up, because I wanted to leave a lot of time for questions from you all. I have 10 more? Okay, great. I'm sorry, okay, thank you. Okay, I have 10 more minutes. And then we're going to leave a lot of room for you all to ask questions. Because
no, you're saying 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Oh, well, why didn't you shut me up? I was trying to be quiet. I really was trying. Okay. The stories in these books are so rich, and they have so much to offer, and I do want to give you a chance to come at them any way you wish. So there are microphones roaming. People have mics in their hands. I don't see them, but I know they do. There's one in the back. So if you have a question, there's one in the front and one in the back. A hand in the back. And then there's a gentleman here in the front. Thank you all. Is there somebody back there? I thought there was a hand back there.
Mr. Joseph, can you speak to the tension between the American left white and the civil rights movement black, either broadly speaking or with a specific anecdote which celebrates or... acknowledges that tension.
In Stokely's time, or?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, in terms of tension between the civil rights movement, the new left, I'll say black power right now. When by 66, when Stokely unleashes the term black power, a great example of both tension and cooperation is going to be his anti-war speech at Berkeley in 1966. So Carmichael is going to be both an inspiration to the Oakland-based Black Panthers because of the activism he's doing in Lowndes County, Alabama, where the original Panthers are. But he's going to have a dispute with the Black Panthers because the Panthers are not letting whites be members of the Panthers, but they're open to alliances. So the Peace and Freedom Party, there's going to be groups called Honky for Huey, Honkies for Huey, many different sort of white progressive left groups. Stokely is going to, in October of 66 at Berkeley, there's a Black Power Conference. It's going to have an enormously important speech that connects Vietnam to this broader anti-imperialist movement. And SNCC had been the first to come out against the war in January of 66 with a broad anti-imperialist statement.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. And the interesting thing about Stokely in October of 66 is the fact that he's criticizing white supremacy in that speech and saying that white students and white privilege, they're complicit in it, and that their job is not to work with the black movement, but to go into the white community and try to end white supremacy. And that becomes a source of tension, but it also, for some, SDS and some other people are going to say that that speech that Stokely gives at Berkeley in October of 66 was such a clear analysis of why the war was wrong. And this is before Dr. King comes out against the war in April of the next year, that they become emboldened to do more anti-war activism, right? And Stokely had done a joint anti-war statement with Carl Oglesby of SDS as well. So there's going to be points of convergence and divergence. But the biggest criticism was a criticism of the politics of white privilege. Stokely's argument was that white liberals, many of whom he had worked with, many of whom, he loved Jonathan Daniels, who died in 1965, fought alongside with him, was that most white liberals, not whites he knew and worked and organized with, were going to go back to the white community and go back to white privilege once this movement had faded. That was his argument.
Gentleman right here.
Thank you so much for an informative presentation. It's very valuable. I would like to do something that may be impossible here for you. I'm not sure. I'd like to just mention certain ingredients of a kind of cake, a black-white social development cake, and see what you people as individuals for the panel as a whole think is the appropriate way to put these ingredients together. For example, we take a look at the condition of African Americans today, and we look at it as against the conditions that are unequal, that are unfair, that are often violent against African Americans. And we would say, this is horrible, terrible, it is not democratic, it is also at odds with what you might call a humane society. On the other hand, there was slavery a long time ago, and recently, and now, we have had the running, and now the President of the United States being an African-American person. So very, very different.
Okay, I'm going to rush you along to your question.
Okay, then let me just mention the words. The protest movements of which I was a part in behalf of the African Americans for example, the 50s, had as the energetic sense, the energetic center, American liberal Jewish people. Just as this has not been told, these stories that you told today, that story has never been told. I think at the same time of Sharpton, of Farrakhan, of even Jesse Jackson during Hymetown. How do you put all these things together? Where are we? Where have we come? What really is the story between blacks and whites and the development of black America?
Well, that's kind of a big question. I'm going to head them off before they go into it because you know they're academics and we're not going to be here for 2 hours. So you're going to give me your best one good sentence in response to this based on your years of research. Go ahead, Mr. Lawyer. Ken Mack.
I can't do it with one sentence, but I'll try to be brief. And, you know, I think probably all the stories that we tell in our books and, you know, hopefully up here, are stories that do have blacks and whites in them. I mean, the lawyers in my book, one of the points of the book is that to be a civil rights lawyer is to be somebody who's on both sides of the color line, and is somebody who actually certain groups of whites feel a lot of in common with. And it's not always the same group of whites. One of the lawyers in my book, this guy named Lauren Miller, who is one of the racially restrictive covenant lawyers, argued in the Supreme Court in 48. In the 1930s, he was a communist. And I don't know why he didn't join the Communist Party. But he goes to the Soviet Union. You know, he is a kind of bridge between the kind of black left and the white left. And then he becomes a civil rights lawyer and is arguing cases for the NAACP. He's a friend of Pat Brown. But he's kind of on both sides of this his whole life. And, you know, if you took a snapshot of him at any time, you wouldn't see it all. But his whole life is kind of wrapped up with activists on both sides of the color line. And I think that's true for many of the people that all of us write about.
Either one of you want to add something? Well, in your case, you got the Durs and everybody else.
We got the Durs. We got Highlander. She goes to Highlander 5 months before she makes her bus stand. She talks about one of the most profound things about Highlander was that she felt like it was the first time she could speak her mind in front of white people and not feel hostility. So I think, and that I think...
It's the Highlander School, your people
It's an adult organizer training school that gets started in Tennessee in the 1930s. And I argue in the book that her visit to Highlander 5 months earlier is very transformative of her own spirit. She gets there very kind of sad and bitter. I mean, that's her word. And so I think being in a space, being in that interracial space was very important.
I also would like to add, just from your book also to your point, is that Rosa Parks was not a well-off person. No. You know, we seem to think of her as middle class. She was not. She was poor. And so many times I was stunned in your book to see how many times the people at Highlander came together to support her so she could eat.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so that's important to know.
Never owns her own home.
Yeah.
Never.
I would say very briefly that there's great scholarship on what you're talking about in terms of Jews in the civil rights movement and white participation in the civil rights movement. So that's been extensively discussed. That hasn't been that's been extensively, in terms of historians and historiography, dealt with, not just biographies, but studies of black and white civil rights participation, and even studies of black and white feminists. You know, Annie Vaux's stuff and Winnie Brines's stuff about black women and white women in the movement. And even Jewish participation, including, there's new studies on even Jewish participation among not just civil rights progressives, but Jews who had a complicated identity in organizations like White Citizens Councils, who were sort of secret Jews in the South, who were at times complicit with not trying to be anti-segregation because they didn't want exposure to who they were in Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, et cetera. So that's there. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I have all those hands come up. How many? I have 1, 2, 3. And this is my last question. So here's what we're going to do. You're going to tell him in the microphone your question, and then they're going to very briefly answer all of them. Come on, let's move. There's one right here in the red.
Tell you.
It out loud.
No, you're just speaking it out loud.
Just say what my question is. Okay.
Yeah.
What I wanted to say, first of all, thank you all, and it was just wonderful to sit here and have read everyone's book. My question is to Pinnell, and that when you talk about Stokely Carmichael, I wanted to get your opinion about this. You know, in 1966, he gives us the term Black Power. We begin to see some of positive results of it, one of which is the 1968 Olympics with John Carlos during the American... During the
Olympics.
The Olympics.
Okay, come on.
We begin to... We also see James Brown anthem. Stayed loud and black.
No question.
Proud. And then one last thing, and then how they shape also black theology in a profound way. So the question I want to ask you, many have argued that, well, this was very simple for Stokely to come up with this term, because by coming from a black Caribbean country, that had a lot to do with giving us a kind of new identity and a new way of thinking about ourselves and understanding power, not just in terms of a symbolic
okay,
way.
Okay, so your question
power.
Is, did it?
Okay,
yeah,
and how did it? And how did it shape black masculinity?
Okay, right behind, right, that's that person. That.
Dr. Joseph, I just had a quick question about the personal relationship between Martin Luther King and Stokely Carmichael. There was that point where they were in the Freedom Rides. Were in that room together for overnight. They were kind of trapped there. And I was wondering, what was that relationship like?
All right. And then the last one is that young lady right there.
Good afternoon. Sorry. My question is primarily for Mr. Mack, which is, what parallels for current lawyers do you see?
All right. Okay. The first one, how did Stokely's, from where he came from with his Caribbean background and all of that, and the times in which he lived, the John Carlos Olympics, the James Brown anthems, all of that richness in that environment shape more than just black masculinity, in fact, influence black theology?
I think that's a great question. Yes, it did, all those things. I think that Carmichael's background, but also the movement that preceded him, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, the Nation of Islam, that was all black power. So what he's doing is popularizing, that term. And certainly it's going to influence black theology, black masculinity in both positive and negative ways, just the idea of gender in both positive and negative ways. So you're going to have black feminists who are saying they're black power activists and socialists, Fran Beal, Third World Women's Alliance. National Black Feminist Organization, Combahee River Collective. But then you're also going to have those who are criticizing misogyny and sexism within that movement. But certainly his background, his pan-Caribbean background, is very, very important on that score.
Ken Mack, Lawyers Today.
Lawyers Today.
Parallels to Lawyers Today.
Two things to say. You know, we always write history in the present. It's influenced by the present. But we, you know, you ask us what should we do. You know, we're kind of the wrong people to ask. But, you know, my book is written in the present. I think a lot about sort of where civil rights lawyers are today. And, you know, a lot of what I think I'm trying to say in the book is to be a lawyer is to be somebody who can see the problems of your group, whatever the group is that you claim to represent, through the eyes of somebody else, right? So that's a kind of Du Boisian double consciousness idea. And it really animates, you know, the way I read the lawyers in this book. But it's always it's also a kind of really modern idea, too. I mean, there's one review of my book which says it's kind of written in the shadow of Obama being president, and it kind of is and it isn't. But what I'm really trying to get people to see is, like, is to be a lawyer is to be kind of in the middle, to kind of see the world from both sides, and that you get more for your cause by being able to do that. And these lawyers who really existed in a world in which, you know, you were supposed to be separate became famous in their own time because of their ability to do exactly that.
Okay. Martin Luther King and Stokely Carmichael relationship, did they spend that night together? What did they talk about?
Well, they weren't freedom riders, but they did spend weeks together on the Meredith March in 1966, and they become good friends. They first met in 63. Stokely has enormous respect for King. King mentors Stokely. Stokely's anti-war activism inspires King. They have a teasing relationship. So one anecdote is that they're at a huge anti-war rally, April 15th, 1967, and there's 400,000 people there. And Stokely steals the show, you know, anti-war, anti-Vietnam. He has this huge radical speech. Afterwards, they're at Harry Belafonte's sprawling 18-room apartment in New York City, the one that he sold for many millions of dollars a few years ago. And Stokely is teasing King because King has come out against the war, and he's saying, it's my activism and my speeches, and Stokely's being investigated by the Justice Department and stuff, that has made you do this. And King sort of admits yes. And a couple of weeks later, King's in Atlanta, and he's going to do an even bigger anti-war speech at Ebenezer Baptist Church, his father's church, his family church. And he calls up Stokely Carmichael that night and says, what are you doing tomorrow? Are you going to church? And Stokely says, no, like a good heathen, I'm not going to church. I'm going to work for the people. And King implores him to come to church because he's going to come out against the war. And Stokely says, I'm going to be in the front row of that pew when you make your speech tomorrow. And in Eyes on the Prize, you can see that Stokely Carmichael, along with Cleve Sellers, and Stokely, you know, he's indoors with the sunglasses, of course. He leads the standing ovation when King concludes that speech by saying he's not going to study war no more, right? So there's a huge relationship with them, which hopefully is teased out in the book. But there's a real love for each other, and Stokely later says he would have died for Dr. King.
Okay, I have a moderator's privilege, because, you know, I can't leave Sister here without a question. Sorry. Okay, so let me just ask this. Rosa Parks fought all the time to tell people she wasn't what people thought she was. Did she ever just get weary and just let people just let it wash over her and just, you know, go with the myth, because it was just too hard to keep fighting back against the myth?
Yes. I mean, I think both she often talks about how she knows she's a symbol. She would tell these stories where she said, you know, people would ask her if she knew Harriet Tubman.
Yeah.
You know, and I think she was willing to, I think Rosa Parks, when she decided that night, December 1st, that she was willing to do this. I mean, I don't think she had any sense of how big it was going to be, but she understood she was saying that she was willing to deal with a lot. And so I think sometimes she just let people, she just kept doing her thing. And I think she recognized, and she gets an award from the National, one of the first big awards Rosa Parks gets, 1968, she gets an award from the National Press Club. And they basically are, she gets up there and she says, you know, this idea of a tired feet, I kind of think of it as a joke. And she says it in her very, like Rosa Parks, you know, very understated way. But I think she was both, you know, she was sort of used to it, and she found it extremely annoying.
Thank you all so much. Now, before you move, wait, before you clap, very important information. They're going to be signing over here on this table their books, and you'll want to get these books. They are incredible, each one of them. Y'all know I don't lie. And I want you to give them a rousing applause.